title of today's web-based seminar is Promoting Mental Health and Preventing Suicide Among Older Adults. Our presenters will be Yates Conwell, Chris Myra, and Rosalind Blosier. And in a few minutes, I'll introduce our first presenter, Dr. Yates Conwell, and he will begin his presentation. But first, I'd like to provide a little orientation to the software we're using for this event. Right now, you should be logged into GoToWebinar on your computer, looking at a PowerPoint slide that welcomes you to this webinar. If that's not your experience right now and you need technical assistance, please call SPRC Training Institute staff at area code 307-438-9321. Again, that's 307-438-9321. And even if we are unable to quickly resolve your technical difficulties due to a firewall problem or some other issue at your institution that makes it difficult to connect, we will make sure that you can get a copy of the presentation and follow along on your own computer as we move through today's presentation. Just stay connected to this phone line, and you'll be able to hear as you progress the slides on your own screen. Again, the number to call is 307-438-9321. If you can hear what I'm saying, then you've already successfully connected to the conference line, which we're using today. The phone number is also posted on your screen, so if you have colleagues who are having difficulty hearing, you may want to ask them to connect to the phone line as well. Your phone lines will be muted during this entire webinar because we have an unprecedented number of people participating in this event. And if we unmute all of your lines, the background noise is likely to be quite distracting. After today's presentation, actually after the first presentation by Dr. Conwell, and then again after the second presentation by our last two presenters, we will have Q&A sessions. So rather than unmute the lines and have you all speak your questions, we're going to ask you to write your questions and comments via the Q&A box on your screen. So if you look at your screen right now, you should see both the slide that's welcoming you as well as a box at the top of your screen which has some information. If you haven't expanded it, it might look like a little box with a red arrow pointing to the left, in which case you want to click that little red arrow and make the screen expand. If you were to click the arrow again, it collapses. So some of you may be having fun doing that on your screen as I say that. You'll see there that you can post a question, and if you click send, it will come to me. And I will voice your questions to the presenters. So it would be useful if you not only post your question, but also put in parentheses or after your question where you work or the context in which you work, because it'll give me a little more information for the presenter and might make it easier for our presenters to answer your question in a way that's relevant for you. I'll be able to see the name, your name as well when you post the question, so I will say who asked the question, just to personalize this whole experience. And if you have any technical questions or other questions that come in, we'll answer them throughout the webinar and save the questions for the presenters for that Q&A time. We'll do our best to answer all the questions and comments, but we might not be able to get to all of them. So we'll do our very best. You may have noticed in that little information box on your screen the number of participants at this event. Right now, I see that our attendee list indicates that there are 610 people connected to this webinar via the GoToWebinar site. That actually is indicating the number of computers that are connected. I know that we have some groups that are all sharing a single computer screen projected on the wall or their large computer screen monitor. So I'm sure we have more than 617 people participating right now. It's wonderful to see this level of interest. We actually had 1,200 people register, so we usually have about 50% able to show up due to other obligations on the actual day of the event. I looked at the list of registrants and was delighted to see that we had registrants from all 50 states, the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, and we even have people on the line from Canada. So I want to give you all a warm welcome and let you know that even though it sounds very quiet on this line, you're here with a lot of other colleagues who share your interests. So welcome to all. So with that said and without any further ado, I'd like to introduce today's presenters so we can get right into it, and then I'll introduce the other two presenters a little bit later. Our first presenter today is Dr. Yates Conwell. Dr. Conwell is professor of psychiatry and vice chair in the Department of Psychiatry, as well as co-director of the Center for the Study and Prevention of Suicide at the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry. He received his medical training at the University of Cincinnati and completed his psychiatry residency and fellowship in geriatric psychiatry at Yale University School of Medicine. In addition to teaching and clinical care, Dr. Conwell directs a multidisciplinary program of research in suicide prevention with a special emphasis on later life. He is a consultant to suicide prevention efforts in the U.S., Europe, and China, and serves as a member of the steering committee of the Suicide Prevention Resource Center here. So I could say much more, but I know you're eager to hear from him directly. So without any further introduction, I'll just pass it on to you, Dr. Conwell. And Tiffany, you may need to unmute his line. Okay. We're having a moment of technical difficulty, so hang in there, everyone. And my colleague here will unmute Dr. Conwell's line so he can start his presentation.
Okay. Then we're ready to go. Thank you very much, Shan, for the introduction, and thank you all for participating here. I'd say good afternoon, but people are from so many different places. I don't know if it's morning in some places, and otherwise the response here is really terrific for a topic that's of critical public health importance, but tends to kind of fly under the radar a little bit. So it's most gratifying to see so many people here with us today. I'd like to move ahead. Got to get my slides up here, and I'll have to rely on Tiffany for that, I think. Okay. There we go.
Yates, I think you're able to. Yeah, there you go. You can.
Yeah, I got it now. Good. Well, I first of all want to acknowledge some collaborators, and less for the individual names, because there are so many of them, and simply to make the point that when we deal with suicide at any age, it is a very complex behavior and really requires input from all sorts of different disciplines. And the work that we do here represents that, with input from folks, not just from psychiatry and psychology, clinical psychology, social psychology, epidemiology, sociology, and many more different disciplines. It does take a village to tackle this really complicated and important issue. The objectives of, The objectives that I have for the time that I have with you today, about a half an hour, and then we'll open it up for some questions, are these: to first review the epidemiology of suicide in later life, to think with you about risk and protective factors, what do we know about that, largely from retrospective psychological autopsy studies and a few others, to talk about the special characteristics of suicide in senior living communities of various sorts to the extent that we know, and then to outline a framework on which to base development of a comprehensive program of late life preventive interventions, give you a way to think about this this complicated topic. First, though, I want to ask you kind of to provide a little bit of background about the scope of this problem, albeit one that we hear relatively little about. If you could. How is this going to work now? Let's see. Okay. Quick poll. Have you known of an older adult who died by suicide? Simple question. I'll leave it to you to interpret. But please check yes or no for that. And this is background, as I said, because it's not something one hears a lot about. It's a very stigmatized behavior in our country and in many parts of the world. So to The consequence of that, unfortunately, is that people live with it silently, trying to struggle with the effects of being a survivor of a friend or a loved one who dies by suicide. And I think often the impression is that that's less of an issue for people who lose an older friend. friend or relative or loved one to suicide than perhaps might be the case for younger people. Let's see what the experience is of those involved here. So well over half of those of you listening in today have known of an older person who died by suicide. That's typical. It happens. And when any individual dies by suicide, it touches a great many other people. Go ahead now. I want to give you one example of I want to talk about a guy here in Rochester that was influential, to say the least, in the structure. I'm not able to move the slides at this point for some reason. You can help me with that.
Could you try clicking on it with your mouse?
Yep. Okay. That's probably what I need to do. Thank you for reminding me.
Go.
This is a picture of George Eastman, and George Eastman was the founder of Eastman Kodak Company, which was by far the largest employer here in the Rochester area. And George Eastman was kind of the Bill Gates of his era, massively successful industrialist and philanthropist who had an impact on people's lives, certainly throughout this community, throughout the United States, and in many other parts of the world as well. Well, George Eastman called his advisors into his bedroom in his mansion in Rochester on March 14th, 1932, when he was 77 years old, made some changes to his will, sent them away, wrote this note, "My work is done, why wait?" and then shot himself in the left chest with a pistol and died. And the response to that, to his death in the community, was one of certainly reverence, a serious loss, but one that I think was facilitated as a grieving process by the simplicity of his message. George Eastman left a note that implied that he had exited life the way he had lived it, on his terms. And certainly that's the way we want to think about suicide in our senior population, as people who are remaining in control. But the reality is always much more complex, and that was the case in Mr. Eastman's death as well. He had been for years suffering from a degenerating disease of his spine. It was causing him a great deal of pain, impairing his function, making it difficult to walk. He had had to withdraw from his business activities a long time before. He had become more and more isolated, lost the few friends that he was left with recently to illness as well. He was a lonely, isolated man who became increasingly desolate and hopeless. And his suicide happened in that context. And that's typical of suicide in older adults. It's not caused by any one thing, and it's not a simple matter, much as we would like to think it is. But how large a problem is suicide in late life? It's certainly been an issue among all of us here on this call, or the great majority. In the United States, every year there are about 34,500 suicides, and about 5,400 of them are among older people. The rate of suicide among people over the age of 65 is about 14 to 15 per 100,000, which is about 40 to 50% higher than the rate in the general population. But you see, as depicted here in this graph, that the variation is remarkable as a function of age, gender, race, and other variables. So here we have four curves. The bottom two are women and the top two are men, white men, black men, white women, and black women. So a couple take-home messages from this. One is that in general, across the life course, suicide is more common among men than women, that suicide is more common among white than non-white populations by and large. And that the story of suicide in older adulthood in the United States is largely accounted for by suicide in men and this tremendous increase in old age among suicide in older white men. I'd say, however, that in many, if not most, countries in the world, this pattern is a little atypical in that suicide rates rise throughout the life course for both men and women to high peaks in later life. Now, there's a special characteristic of suicide in older adulthood, which I'd like to first get your impressions of in the second of only two poll questions I'm going to ask. And this is that studies show between 100 to 200 young people attempt suicide for each person who dies by suicide. Among older adults, how many do you think attempt suicide for each one who takes his or her own life? You have five choices to make there. Just I'll leave you for a moment to pick one, and then we'll look to see what people have to say. Where I'm going with this is to show that there are special characteristics about suicide in late life which makes it, in some ways, a special challenge for prevention. One that frames how we need to think about this as a public health problem rather than purely, for example, a medical or psychiatric problem. Okay. All right, so the majority of folks picked 25, so considerably less in general, you would believe, than is the case for younger people, and that's true, but actually the closest answer is number five, that there are about four. In some studies, people say one or two attempted suicides for each completed suicide among older adults. We can go back to the slides. Okay. Now, there are several reasons for why that might be the case, which we'll show when the slides come back up.
Sorry, I'm just having a little bit of a hard time closing that one.
Uh-huh.
Give me one second.
Okay. There are several reasons why that might be the case, that the lethality of suicide in older adults is so high. And you're probably thinking of them now. And one of them is clearly that older people tend to have more medical illness, tend to be more physically frail, so that any attempt, any effort to harm oneself is more likely to result in death. The second is that older people in general tend to be more isolated, live alone, be less likely to be found by other people, so that the result of an attempt is more likely to be death because they're less likely to be rescued. And then a third, no less important, is that older people as a group, when they get suicidal, tend to act on that feeling with more determination and with greater lethality than is the case for younger people. An example of that would be, for example, that in the United States, where we have a bit of a love affair with guns, 50 to 55% of suicides of the general population are with a firearm. Among older adults, however, that figure rises to 75% or so. So a great majority of older people die with a firearm, having made very careful plans in a way that makes it unlikely that they will survive that attempt. Let's see. Now, there are several implications of that. One is that when one encounters a suicidal person in one's clinical practice or in the community, one needs to be very vigilant about getting that person help, intervening in an aggressive way, because it's likely that if that individual were to act on their suicidal feelings, that they would die as a result. The second, though, is that older people that we're going to save a lot more lives among older people by focusing more on prevention of development of suicidal crises or suicidal states than we are by focusing on intervention at the point that they become suicidal. And I will come back to that issue when we can talk about the framework for suicide prevention.
Excuse me, sorry, Yates?
Yeah.
I'm having a hard time. It isn't seeming to want to close the poll. So I'm just trying to figure.
I can just keep rambling. If there's anything you want me to do, let me know.
Okay. Well, I will continue to work on
this. Want me to try to close this?
No, because it's not from your end. So I will just continue to work on it. But I just wanted to let you know what was going on.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, so how then do we think about prevention? How do we move from knowing that this is a really large and serious problem to knowing that to intervention? Well, first we got to know about risk factors. What is it that puts older adults at risk for suicide? When we get the slides back up, I'll show you that the best way to think about that is in my view, domains. That there are a variety of different domains, no one of which is sufficient to explain why an individual would die. It's not Mr. Eastman did not kill himself because he had a chronic pain syndrome. And somebody doesn't kill themselves because they're depressed or because they have cancer or lost a spouse. It's always that these factors come together in a particular individual with particular vulnerabilities at a particular point in time. Those domains that I think are probably most salient for us to think about today are, first, psychiatric illness. We know that suicide rates are increased among people with all sorts of psychiatric diagnoses, but one of the particular characteristics of suicide in older adulthood is that depression appears to, or affective disorders more broadly, clinical depression has a very tight relationship to suicide in older adulthood. A little different than at younger ages when a variety of different psychiatric illnesses and often appearing together as what we call comorbid syndromes are tend to be more common. In older adulthood, though, if one has a major depression or a clinical depression, one is at probably somewhere on the order of 50 to 100 times greater risk for suicide than an older person without that condition. We know that rates are increased in older people who have schizophrenia, anxiety disorders, alcohol and substance use disorders across the board, perhaps not as powerfully affected by those things with regard to suicide risk as is the case for mood disorders. One of the curious things from the research is that dementia, which is so common and so destructive for older adults and their families, does not appear by the methods that we've used to study this issue to increase risk for suicide. We can talk more about that perhaps as time permits. I don't think it's accurate. I think that's an artifact, and we need to understand a lot more about the impact of cognitive disorders very early on in their presentation. Another domain is social factors. We know that independent of depression, that social isolation, losses of various kinds, functional impairments and the impact they have on one's life and self-image as an older person all increase risk for suicide a bit, as well as medical illness. Cancers, neurological conditions, and some studies suggest heart disease, lung disease, a variety of conditions have that impact of increasing suicide risk. More important, though, I think, is not so much the diagnosis of a medical condition as what the meaning is of that condition for the older person. What significance does it have for them psychologically and in terms of their functioning and ability to maintain their lives in a way that's acceptable to them. Also, I should mention personality characteristics. Although they're not very clearly highly predictive of suicide by any means, there is a background character of kind of rigidity, restricted coping style that is associated with increased suicide risk in older adulthood. And finally, probably, although the data are weak here, a biological predisposition may operate here, in which there are changes in the neurochemistry in the brain that might predispose some individuals to either develop depressive disorders and become suicidal in that context, or to be impulsive or aggressive. And if the depression predisposes to aggression towards the self, suicide may result. So a list of risk factors for suicide that one should go through are those demographic characteristics of older age, male gender, white race, relative to others, psychiatric illness and depression in particular. A prior history of suicidal ideation or attempts is an important one. The presence of life stressors, and in particular, discord or problems in one's support network that make one disconnected from one's circle of supports. Physical health problems, functional impairments, particularly pain, painful syndromes, those kinds of things. So we know that it's a problem. We know what the risk factors are, so therefore what people who may be at risk look like. What then can we say about how to use that information? Well, we've got to know where to look. And this is what we call kind of points of engagement. If we're going to be able to intervene, we know what to look for, but where do we find those people? And for older adults, it's not in mental health settings. Older adults relatively rarely will seek out a mental health clinic or mental health provider for help. Instead, older people go to their primary care doctor. Virtually all older people in the United States have an identified primary care doctor. And in fact, studies have shown again and again that a great majority, close to three-quarters of older people who died by suicide actually had been in their primary care provider's office in the last 30 days of life or so, and maybe a third to a half in the last week. So here's at least one place where the opportunity exists to identify and intervene. Another, of course, is out in the community in a variety of different places. So social service agencies, because of the social circumstances, functional impairments, social isolation, financial problems, and so on, that represent risk factors. So I would count that as a possibility. Faith communities, churches, synagogues, because of the protective factor we believe that is provided by religion for suicide in older adults. Then also individuals living in congregate living facilities are an important option here, and one that we've come here today to talk in somewhat greater detail about. What do we know, actually, about how suicide appears in congregate living facilities? And unfortunately, we don't know nearly enough. We know from a couple of studies that in senior retirement communities, for example, a study showing that some issues like a pessimistic outlook on life, work my way through this again as I continue to talk. It's not moving yet, so I'll just carry on. Pessimistic outlook on life, the sense of hopelessness, poor sleep, increased alcohol use. These have all been, and being disconnected to others is another factor in that one study. But we don't know really very much beyond that. We know that
I think that you can advance the slides now if you want to try clicking on the PowerPoint.
Okay. All right. Let me just proceed a pace here to catch up to where I was talking about. Okay. Good. One more, I think. Okay. Suicide in senior living communities. Whoops, okay. One of the things we do know is that, as in other parts of the community, suicide is very closely associated with diagnosable psychiatric illness in nursing homes, from Finnish studies and Italian studies, and mostly affective disorders. The rates of suicide, near as we can tell, in nursing homes are higher than in the general population of older adults, particularly when one considers that the gender distribution tends to be more skewed towards women in long-term care settings than in the general community. And women in that age range tend to have lower suicide rates. So we can generalize to say that people in long-term care, in nursing homes at least, tend to have increased risk in general. There is one study by Osgood, which was a survey of nursing homes, which derived the results you see at the bottom of the screen there, that there are some characteristics associated in her survey with increased suicide in nursing homes, and those are ones that tend to be larger, lower cost, with fewer resources available, greater staff turnover, and for reasons that I'm not clear, those that are have a religious or other affiliation rather than those that are public or private. But that's kind of the extent to what we know about the risk factors for and characteristics of suicide in older adults in senior living communities, and I think one should comfortably rely on our knowledge of risk factors in the older adult population in general. So how do we take that information to create a framework for understanding prevention? And this is a perspective I will offer, not spend time on, we don't have that time today, but to say that I see this best understood as a developmental process, that people arrive at a decision to take their own lives on a trajectory that builds over time and therefore offers a lot of different points at which one might intervene. There is at its foundation kind of a personality, a social ecology, a set of cultural values and perceptions that we face old age with. We face the challenges of old age that are inevitable, and some among us will become symptomatic or less resilient, and some among those people will become more hopeless and depressed and despondent and consider suicide as an option. And some among them will actually act on it and die. So I think of this as a developmental process that suggests that there are different approaches to suicide prevention that are most appropriate at different points in that developmental sequence. And we'll use a couple of terms in our discussion today, at-risk population approaches and prevention approaches and whole population prevention. At-risk I'm using to define as preventive interventions focusing on symptomatic people and those with defined risk factors, interventions that are designed to prevent the implementation of suicidal behavior or to prevent full-blown disorders of which suicidal behavior is a part. Whereas whole population approaches focus on the entire population as a target, irrespective of the risk associated with any individual. So prevention through reducing more distal risk factors and enhancing health and well-being overall. And in general, there is a distribution of risk in the population, which is what this figure is intended to show, where the great majority of people fall in a low-risk category. And there is a little tail out to the right of people who are at higher risk. And the function of an at-risk approach would be to target those who have symptoms who are closer to the right side of that developmental sequence, to identify them, to intervene by treating and reducing risk for that group. Whereas let me give you an example of that. This is a picture very quickly of all of the studies submitted to the Food and Drug Administration looking at antidepressants and placebos among people of all ages who have depressive disorders. And what they went back to look at was whether, in fact, giving an antidepressant made people more suicidal. There was a real concern about that, and it resulted in the institution of what you might recall was called a black box warning for antidepressants, targeting primarily younger adults and adolescents. And the reason for that concern, although it's controversial whether the institution of a black box warning in fact had an impact on suicide rates one way or the other, but that suicide did appear in those studies to be somewhat increased in those under the age of 25. It was kind of indeterminate, no apparent risk or difference from placebo in those in middle life, but very clearly a significant decrease in suicide risk for suicidal ideation and behavior among people in older adulthood receiving antidepressants relative to those on placebo. An example of an at-risk intervention. Another might be depicted here. There's a study of older people, mostly women, 84%, who in Italy were referred to a social service because they were at risk of being hospitalized or institutionalized. And they were equipped with remote voice-activated telephone support, linkage to a social work staff who was there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to intervene and help support people to maintain independent living and a good quality of life. And they found that in people who received that service, there was a substantially reduced suicide rate relative to people who would not in the general population of those ages. The problem was that the service seemed to be effective in reducing suicide only in women and not apparently in men. And as I wind up, I want to make 2 points about that. First of all, the whole population approach is one which tries to shift the entire risk curve to the left in this figure that you see, and thereby influence the development of suicidal states. They change the likelihood of entering a trajectory to suicidal crisis in a vast, in a far larger population than would be the case for at-risk approaches. So there's a place for both of these. And let me offer one example very quickly. Removal of carbon monoxide from domestic gas in the United Kingdom. You see in this curve that over 20 years, the UK systematically removed carbon monoxide from domestic gas. And over that period of time, what they observed for both men and women was a serial reduction in carbon monoxide poisoning suicides for both men and women, no change in suicide rates due to other means, and overall reductions during that period of time for suicide in both sexes. That's not specific to older adults. There are very few examples of whole population approaches. And then finally, the conclusion, I think the take-home message would be, we think that the best suicide prevention strategy for a community would be one that combines at-risk and whole population approaches, what we might call a multi-layered suicide prevention effort. And we have a lot of work to do to find opportunities to test such interventions. Unfortunately, we still have a challenge. We don't know how to really reach men quite as effectively as women. This slide is indicating a series of studies done in Japan, in addition to the DeLeo telehelp telecheck intervention I just described, in which there were a variety of different approaches used that did tend to result in significant reductions in suicide among women, but without being able to show such an effect on men. So we're left with that challenge and that question. And I think that's it. Thank you for your attention. I think in the interest of time, refer to San whether we should take questions now or move on to the second presentation.
Sure. Well, thank you so much for that. This is Zan with the Suicide Prevention Resource Center again. Fascinating presentation, and thank you for weathering the technical difficulties. My apologies to all who experienced frustration missing some of the slides. We have the email addresses of everyone who logged on to GoToWebinar today. So rather than put you through the trouble of going to our website and downloading the presentation slides, we will email to you by the end of the day tomorrow a full copy of today's presentation slides so that you can look at the slides that you were unable to view today. So you can look forward to that. And if you are sharing a computer with someone and you would like your own copy of the presentation slides sent to you, then you can email your contact information to Tiffany Kim, our training coordinator here, and her email address is tkim@edc.org, and we'll make sure all of you have a copy of the slides. We will spend about 5 minutes on Q&A now and then move on to the next presentation, and you will have another chance to ask Dr. Conwell questions after the next presentation. So if you have questions now, go ahead and write them into the question box on your screen. I'll take a few of them now. I'll save the rest for later, and we'll address as many as we can by the end of today's webinar. So I'll start with a few that have come in already. There is a question here from, I apologize for those of you who I may be mispronouncing the name. We have a question from Eleni Halimariam, who asks, is there a suicide screening tool that you recommend for older adults who deny suicidality when asked directly, but are in fact at high risk?
That's a complicated question because there are different pieces to it. And there's a thought there in the question that the person is at high risk, but they're denying suicidality. You have a concern about them. And I think to some extent, you need to go with the whole picture. I'm very reluctant to, in general, recommend screening tools without understanding them to be administered in a clinical context that understands the subtlety of this. That said, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force has not recommended the use of suicide screening tools in primary care settings. They do recommend the use of depression screening tools, and in part that's because the ability to, the predictive value of those screening tools for suicidality is so low. And so one backs up and asks, how can we get the best sort of bang for the buck, as it were, for prevention resources, and identifying people who are depressed, and then by routine screening, which I think I do advocate strongly, using measures such as the PHQ-9, which you can look up, or the GDS, the Geriatric Depression Scale, very easily used measures in clinical settings. And then when somebody meets criteria for or scores above a cutoff for depression, then certainly really probing about issues of suicidal ideation. Now, I think that's imperfect. I'm not really comfortable with that because there are people, as I said before, who do end up taking their own lives without depression diagnoses. So if you're concerned about that, I think it's perfectly legitimate to use like a two-item screen or even a single item that says, have you been having thoughts that life isn't worth living? I mean, I think most people will respond engaging in a conversation to an open-ended question like that that doesn't have a value attached to it. So I just start there and then go from there through the sequence of questions that helps to determine whether the person is having active suicidal ideation and planning, in which case aggressive intervention is necessary, or thoughts of death, which may or may not be normal developmentally for any older person.
Thank you. We have a question from Karen Aikman, who wants to know how you're defining older age.
Yeah. Well, It varies, certainly. I think the standard in most of the studies that I'm referring to is 60 or 65. It does vary. I think the clinical reality that I'm talking about, though, is one that's more qualitative. It's issues related to aging. Chronological age doesn't help us so much anymore, as people well know. You've got very vibrant young people in their 60s and 70s and on up, and other people who are really struggling with issues that we commonly associate with age in their 50s and 60s. So it's broad.
And I have a question from Mark Lombardo, who asked, what is the strength of religion as a protective factor, and are there limitations to its effects?
Yeah, we don't have very good data about the strength of the association, which, you know, in research terms we talk about in terms of an odds ratio or a relative risk or so on. We know that on an epidemiologic basis that people from Catholic backgrounds, for example, or Catholic countries tend to have lower suicide rates and risks than people from Protestant backgrounds and so on. More to the point, though, I think, is the observation that among people who have been suicidal or actually taken their own lives, they are more likely not to be involved in organized religion, not to be engaged in churches, congregations, and also that among people with some proximal risk factor states like depression or functional impairments and physical problems, that religiosity, religious engagement, tends to improve prognosis, help people be more likely not to get depressed or to resolve the depression, to be responsive to treatment if they are involved with religion. So those things kind of add up to our understanding it as a risk factor. But how potent it is, not so sure.
Okay, and I'm going to pose one last question, and then, as I said, we will have more opportunities for the other questions that have been written in to be posed towards the end. We received several questions about a program called Healthy Ideas, asking if you are familiar with that program and your opinion of its outcomes in terms of really making a difference in the depressive symptoms of older adults and reducing suicide risk.
Yeah, and Healthy Ideas is a terrific program that basically is on a kind of a collaborative care model. And I'd rather, because I don't know so much about the details of Healthy Ideas, refer to the broader construct that older adults with depression, as I said before, tend to present not in mental health but in primary care and social service settings, and that it's a multi-determined illness that precedes suicide, so that systems of care that coordinate social service interventions with mental health and primary care interventions that include certain aspects of what's called the chronic disease management model, patient activation, education, giving people control and information that they can work with to make their lives better. Those things are demonstrably effective. Healthy Ideas is one such program. The PEARLS approach from the people at the University of Washington is another, implemented in community-based social service agencies. And in primary care, other collaborative care interventions have been proven effective in a number of very, very well-done trials as well. So they are important interventions to understand and implement.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, and we will pose more questions to you after the next presentation. Thank you again, Dr. Kumla.
Thank you.
So our next presentation is going to focus on promoting mental health and preventing suicide, but specifically a toolkit that's been developed for senior living communities. And we have two presenters for this next portion of our webinar. The first one is Chris Myra. She's a senior project director at Education Development Center with many years' experience planning, implementing, and evaluating government-funded programs to prevent injuries, violence, and suicide. She is Director of Training and Administration at the Suicide Prevention Resource Center, and in collaboration with the National Association of Mental Health Program Directors and with funding from SAMHSA, Ms. Myra also played a key role in the development of something called Mental Health Promotion and Suicide Prevention, a toolkit for senior living communities. She directed EDC's efforts to use the results of an environmental scan and formative research to create a guide and training manual for the toolkit. Our other presenter is Rosalyn, or Roz Blosier, who graduated with a Master of Science degree in Social Work from Simmons College in Boston, Massachusetts, where her studies were funded by a two-year NIMH grant in Community Mental Health Services to the Cambridge-Somerville, Massachusetts Mental Health Catchment Area. Upon graduation, she briefly worked in Child Protective Services and then was employed as an outpatient mental health therapist for a number of years in a variety of settings and locations. She worked in a community health center on the mental health unit, served in the Department of Psychiatry for a large urban health maintenance organization, and maintained a private practice. And additionally, she served as a family program director on an inpatient drug and alcoholism treatment unit. She's engaged in treatment with individuals, couples, groups, as well as creating psychoeducational programs in the areas of stress management, addiction, eating disorders, and women's issues. She moved with her family to the Netherlands for 7.5 years, where she had a private practice that included running groups for parents with challenging children and completing home studies for expatriates, adopting children domestically and internationally. And she continued working in the field of adoption upon her return to the D.C. area before becoming a public health advisor with the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, where she is still a public health advisor. And she was very involved in the development of the toolkit you'll be hearing about today, the Toolkit for Senior Living Communities. So without further ado, I'll turn this presentation over to them, and I'll let the two of you take it away. Thank you.
Thanks, Anne. This is Roz Blosier. Chris Meyer and I will be introducing you to a newly developed toolkit for older adults entitled Promoting Mental Health and Preventing Suicide, a Toolkit for Senior Living Communities. After I present, Chris is going to talk about the research that was involved in bringing the toolkit into practice. But first, I want to speak briefly about the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, also called SAMHSA, the organization that I represent and which funded the creation of this toolkit. SAMHSA is an agency that's committed to reducing the impact of substance abuse and mental illness on the American population, and as part of this commitment, fully supported the creation of this older adult toolkit. The agency has identified several strategic initiatives to focus its work on to improve lives and capitalize on emerging opportunities. And the older adult toolkit fits perfectly into the top two priorities relative to prevention and trauma. In the development of our toolkit, we had a very particular focus and goals. We partnered with individuals and groups across the country, and we're making an effort to measure the usefulness and effectiveness of our product by inviting those who download or order a print copy of the toolkit to participate in a survey 3 months after obtaining the toolkit. Our work on the toolkit was driven by the knowledge that behavioral health is essential to health, that prevention works, that treatment is effective, and that people do recover. And now on to the toolkit. This toolkit was created through a contract called the SPARC contract, which is an acronym for Suicide Prevention Assessment and Resources Kit. And the lead on this contract was the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors, or NASHPD, in the lead, along with subcontractors that include the Education Development Center, McFarland & Associates, and NRI. But before I go on, I also want to provide a definition of senior living communities for the purposes of this presentation and the toolkit. So our target populations for the toolkit are nursing homes, assisted living facilities, independent living facilities, or continuing care retirement communities, which might include any of the above. Okay, we're going to just do a quick poll, and hopefully we won't get stuck here. I'd like to know a little bit about you. So can you just take a moment to check the one location which best describes where you work? Thanks. Okay. So, are we ready? Okay. Great. Thank you. Okay, thanks for participating in this poll because it's helpful just to learn more about who our audience is. Okay, can we move on? Let's see. Oh, fantastic. The original ideas and framework for the toolkit grew out of a summit entitled It Takes a Community, a summit on opportunities for mental health promotion and suicide prevention in senior living communities, which was held on October 15th and 16th in 2008 at the Asbury Methodist Village in Gaithersburg, Maryland. This summit was mounted as a response to three known deaths by suicide in 2004 and 2005 that the suburban Washington, D.C. senior living community experienced. At the time of these deaths, a letter was written by the executive director to the residents stating, and I quote, "Loved ones and friends left in the wake of suicide found themselves in a state of disbelief, despair, and oftentimes remorse. A community in disbelief and grief found itself asking, 'What do we do now?' There are so many tough questions and no simple answers or playbook to guide us out of this dark tunnel," end quote. So in partnership with SAMHSA, the Suicide Prevention Resource Center, the National Institute of Mental Health, and SPAN USA, experts from around the country and residents gathered at this cutting-edge summit to look for ways to prevent similar tragedies among older adults. On this slide, I've also provided a link to the Suicide Prevention Resource Center Library if you're interested in reading the proceedings of the summit, which are very comprehensive and actually very, very well written. Among several outcomes of the summit was the creation of a very particular framework for looking at suicide prevention in senior living communities. This framework has three components and will be referred to quite often in Chris's remarks, and actually Yates mentioned them in his presentation as well. So let me provide some definitions. The whole population approach discusses strategies to promote the mental health of all residents, regardless of their risk for suicide. The at-risk approach discusses how to identify and assist residents who are at a particularly high risk for suicide and related mental health problems. And the crisis response approach focuses on what senior living communities should do after suicide attempts or deaths. And each of these very specific approaches are dealt with in great detail in the guide and drive the framework of the toolkit. We know that suicide impacts those who live in senior communities, those who work with the residents, and the family members and friends of the residents. We also know that suicide risk can be reduced, which is the guidance that's being provided in the toolkit. It was clear at the Asbury Summit that suicide prevention was a challenge for most senior living communities, that suicide had not been sufficiently addressed, and in fact, there was scant research and few resources that could be drawn on. Therefore, SAMHSA wanted to make certain that part of the process of developing the toolkit involved finding out exactly what the field needed. So Chris is going to be describing the process of the team from the fall of 2008 through the summer of 2009 to ensure the toolkit would be as useful as possible and that it would be a significant contribution to the field of suicide prevention and mental health promotion among older adults. And now, Chris is going to take up.
Yes. Thank you, Roz. And thank you for all of you for joining us on this webinar today. So as Roz said, I'm going to describe the process that we used to develop the toolkit and the product that was created as a result. We wanted to make sure that the toolkit met the needs of three audiences, the residents of senior living communities for the people at risk of suicide, the staff who work in these facilities. These are the people who will be using the information provided in the toolkit to help prevent suicide among the residents. And then we also felt it was important to include families because any type of health, mental health promotion efforts are going to be more effective when families are involved. We used a comprehensive process to ensure that the toolkit met the needs of these audiences and was based on the best that science and experience has to offer. So we first examined the literature on suicide among older adults, as well as the research on mental health promotion and suicide prevention among senior living community residents. Much of this research Yates reviewed for us at the beginning of this presentation. So this really helped us get a handle on the science of preventing suicide among older adults. Then we collected suicide prevention resources that were available to senior living communities. We primarily were looking for things that were free or inexpensive, since those are the type of materials that we knew most senior living communities could use. And this helped us identify the gaps that we needed to fill with our toolkit. We then convened an expert work group of 17 researchers and practitioners from the field of suicide prevention and also from the field of older adult health and mental health promotion. Then our team conducted 6 focus groups with staff in 4 senior living communities. We learned about their attitudes towards suicide and their current efforts to prevent suicide in their facilities. We learned about what they needed to help them address this issue. So we used all of this research to inform the development of the toolkit. Then our team continued to involve experts and practitioners as we began writing the components of the toolkit to make sure that the materials were going to be accurate, usable, and effective. So we shared a detailed outline of the toolkit with representatives of national organizations that serve the staff in senior living communities. We interviewed them to find out what they would find most useful, both in terms of the content and the format. We pilot tested the trainings. There's 3 trainings that I'll tell you about in a minute that were included in the toolkit. We pilot tested those in 4 senior living communities. And then finally, our team product tested a draft of the formatted version of the toolkit in 3 senior living communities to make sure that it was easy to use and met the needs of the staff. What we created was a toolkit that included the following components: a guide for administrators and senior managers, which has information and tools for implementing suicide. Seems to be having a mind of its own. Tiffany, that seems to be advancing on its own. Okay, so as I say, the guide has steps for implementing suicide prevention in senior living communities and also a set of tools. Some of the tools we drew from existing resources and some were ones that we created ourselves. The second component in the toolkit is a trainer's manual. It has scripts and PowerPoints for conducting 3 one-hour workshops. The first workshop is for all staff, and it really focuses on those paraprofessionals, nurses, aides, housekeeping, maintenance staff, and so on, who have the most frequent contact with residents. The second workshop builds on the first, and it's really aimed at the professional staff in senior living communities, nurses, mental health professionals, and senior managers. And the third workshop in the trainer's manual is for residents and their families. Finally, the toolkit includes 3 fact sheets for residents. These fact sheets are titled Look Out for the Well-Being of Yourself and Others, Know the Warning Signs of Suicide, and After a Suicide, How to Help Yourself and Others. So you might notice that the 3, each of the fact sheets corresponds to one of the approaches of our framework. In fact, the whole toolkit, as Roz mentioned, is really designed around the framework that was developed at the Asbury Summit. Our premise was that effective suicide prevention in senior living communities has to include activities for the whole population, activities for persons at risk of suicide, and activities that respond to the crisis of a suicide attempt or death. We had found that nursing and mental health professionals in senior living community typically have experience screening for and treating depression and other mental health problems. These activities fall in the at-risk approach. But they indicated that they felt less prepared to use activities to promote mental health among all residents or to respond to a suicide attempt or death. So each chapter in the toolkit guide is dedicated to one of these 3 approaches. Each chapter starts with goals reflecting that approach. And the goals are really based on the research of what seems to work to reduce suicide risk. So this is the first page in the whole population chapter of the guide. And it presents goals for activities affecting all residents in a senior living community. Some of the goals include residents have access to activities that promote their mental health and well-being. Social networks are established among residents. And the physical and social environment promotes mental health and well-being. So basically the goals here really are designed to enhance protective factors against suicide. This is the first page of in the chapter on the at-risk approach. It presents goals targeting those residents who are at higher risk of suicide. The chapter includes goals such as all staff are able to identify and respond to warning signs for suicide. All staff are able to identify risk and protective factors, kind of things that Yates mentioned in his presentation. And all staff are able to recognize symptoms of depression, while appropriately designated staff are able to screen individual residents for depression and ensure that residents who aren't depressed receive treatment. This is the first page of the chapter on the crisis response approach. It has two goals. Policies and protocols for responding to suicide deaths and attempts are created, and staff are trained in their use, and plans for postvention to support residents, families, and staff after a suicide crisis are developed. So while the Asbury Summit provided the rationale for activities addressing all three components of a comprehensive suicide prevention framework, our review of the literature and our focus group research revealed that it was essential to weave certain key messages throughout these activities. Here are some of the messages that we heard were important to convey in the toolkit. One, that it's important for staff, residents, and families to understand that depression is not a normal part of aging and can be prevented, can be treated. It's also important for staff, residents, and families to understand that it's normal and even healthy for older adults to talk about death and dying. But it's also important to be able to tell the difference between normal talk about death and suicidal language. Lastly, stigma is associated with mental health disorders and treatment. Stigma that's associated with mental health disorders and treatment can keep residents from seeking help. And this is particularly true among older adults. The trainer's manual is one way our toolkit helps to convey these messages. The manual uses guided discussions, such as this one you see on the left, on overcoming stigma. This is in the workshop for residents and their families. A review of the literature and input from the focus group participants also revealed the importance of staff having several specific skills. Two of the key skills are recognizing and responding to warning signs of suicide and responding to a suicide death, both immediately and over the long term. The toolkit helps build these skills among staff in a variety of ways. For example, the image on the left shows a handout for all staff on the warning signs of suicide. And the guide recommends ways that you can use this handout in a senior living community setting. The image on the right is a PowerPoint for one of the staff workshops. All three of the workshops actually devote a significant amount of time to helping either staff or residents recognize and respond to the warning signs of suicide. So I've described what some of our research revealed about the types of information and the strategies that needed to be included in the toolkit. But we also learned a lot about the attributes the toolkit should have if it was actually going to be used and not just kept on the shelf. The particularly the practitioners that we met with, told us that the toolkit needed to be comprehensive, flexible, easy to use, and realistic. Practitioners want one-stop shopping. They wanted the toolkit to be complete. In response, we put everything we felt senior living community staff would need into one toolkit. The guide has two parts. The first part has goals and steps. The second part has tools. The tools include protocols, checklists, and guidelines. The trainer's manual has scripts, handouts, and PowerPoints, and the fact sheets have instructions on how to use them. We also felt that the toolkit is comprehensive in that it includes resources for everyone who has a role to play in suicide prevention, the administrators and professional staff who really need to take the lead on implementing the policies and programs recommended in the toolkit, and also the nurses' aides, housekeeping, maintenance, recreation staff, food service workers, who are really in the closest day-to-day contact with residents and are able to really tell when a problem might be developing. And then also we wanted to have things that were targeted to residents and families. Senior living community staff also told us that the toolkit had to be flexible. They said that few senior living communities would be able to do everything recommended in all three approaches of our framework, and they certainly couldn't do everything at once. So we created this self-assessment checklist at the beginning of the toolkit. Senior living community staff can use it to identify and start with the needs and activities that were most important for them. So, for example, if you work in a senior living community and you indicate on the assessment checklist that you do not have a protocol for responding to a suicide death, then you could turn to the crisis response section of the guide to learn how to create and implement such a protocol. If you already have a protocol, then you might start with a different section. Senior living community staff reminded us that they have a lot to do. There's many demands competing with suicide prevention, and they needed a toolkit that was easy to use. So for each goal, there's several basic recommended steps as well as a collection of tools to help implement that step. So, for example, in the chapter on the at-risk approach, one step recommends that staff establish connections with community mental health providers. To assist in this effort, this tool that you see on the screen helps staff create a directory of mental health providers in their community and provides questions that you can ask these providers when you're trying to establish agreements to work together. Finally, staff told us that we had to show them that the activities in the toolkit were realistic. So the toolkit includes a lot of examples of programs and activities that were implemented by senior living communities around the country, to demonstrate that the recommended activities were not just good ideas, but have actually been used and proved doable. For example, this page in the guide includes examples of ways some of the senior living communities that we spoke with have engaged men in activities, created programs in which residents teach classes to other residents, established a peer counseling program, and implemented health promotion programs. So our research demonstrated that although older adults are at elevated risk of suicide, senior living community staff are actually in an excellent position to help reduce this risk. So we drew on the science, knowledge, and experience of suicide prevention experts and the knowledge and experience of senior living community staff to create a toolkit that's both science-based and meets the needs of the people who are actually going to use it. And we hope that this process is actually a useful model of using research to inform practice and create something that's usable and effective. Now, Roz is going to describe how you can obtain a copy of the toolkit.
Okay, so currently you can go online at the link that's been identified here to get to download a web-based version of everything that Chris described. We're also in the process of working on developing and getting a print version published. This print version is, first of all, it's going to be free, and it's going to be delivered in a three-ring binder, and will include a DVD with all three PowerPoints for the three-hour-long training sessions. And you can call this number to get in a queue to order this toolkit when it becomes available in print copy. And I've included some contact information. Please feel free to be in touch with us if we can be of any further assistance. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, both of you. This is Zan Young again with the Suicide Prevention Resource Center. As I mentioned earlier, I encourage those of you who have been listening to the presentations today to send your questions in writing through the interface on your screen. You can type in your question and send it. And I will be reading through those questions and voicing as many of them as I can in the time remaining for our presenters. So go ahead and send your questions about the presentation you just saw, or if you have questions about the first presentation you saw from Dr. Conwell, go ahead and send those, and I will go ahead and share them with them to respond to. Since the questions are just coming in on the last presentation, I'll go ahead and go back to Dr. Conwell for a moment and share some questions that we received kind of multiple inquiries about. Tiffany, have you unmuted Dr. Conwell's line?
Yeah.
Great. Wonderful. We had some questions about illness and suicide risk among older adults. For instance, we received a question from Ellen Krause of the VA Medical Center in Memphis, Tennessee, asking if you could elaborate on the relationship between dementia and suicide risk, or the relationship between mild cognitive impairment and suicide risk.
Sure. Another one of those topics we need to understand better. As I implied, the data are mixed, and even some suggest that dementia is uncommon among people, older people who take their own lives. I think the reality is very different, though. I think that that early on in the process of dementia, when the older person is beginning to get a sense of a problem, that they're beginning to worry about how they're managing their affairs, some slight memory problems, and we all get so anxious about those things. But one of the tricky parts about dementia is that early on in the condition is when one is relatively more likely to see prominent mood symptoms and dysregulation of mood and behavior, and I believe that that's the time at which suicide risk is greatest, and that we aren't recognizing that as a prominent risk factor because it's happening in people at a time of the natural course of their illness when they're less likely to be recognized and diagnosed. So, yes, I do believe that mild cognitive impairment and dementia probably are significant risk factors for suicide in older people, particularly if they are associated with what we call the behavioral and psychological symptoms of dementia, and primarily depression, cognitive impairments of a sort that diminish people's ability to organize responses to cope with situations in their lives, challenges that they face.
Thank you very much. And for Rosalyn Bloger and Chris Myra, we have a question about your definition of a senior living community. So, for instance, would an adult home fit your definition?
And did you say an adult home?
Right. Like, perhaps the broader question of interest to all is, you know, how you've defined the term senior living community. What kinds of settings are included in that?
So this is Chris. Yeah, it was really a defined residential facility that would have some staff on hand. So it was everything from a nursing home to an assisted living facility to an independent retirement community. And then, as Roz said, the continuing care community often contains all those three levels of care.
Great, thank you. And for Dr. Conwell, we received several questions related to the influence of culture on suicide risk among older adults. So, for instance, we had the question of are there any cultural studies or patterns related to the types of suicide attempts among older adults? And another person phrased it differently and said, does suicide among older adults vary significantly among different cultures? So these questions came in from people in Pennsylvania, Virginia, and California.
Yeah, good question. So culture clearly is an important influence here, and we know that simply looking within the United States across parts of the country as it relates to suicide rates. They tend to be very low in the Northeast in general, rise as you go south and west to the intermountain states. And so, for example, the rate of suicide overall in Nevada, again, for example, is about three times higher than it is here in the Northeast. And then looking across countries, I mentioned that suicide rates tend to drop in older adulthood for women here, whereas, for example, in China, suicide rates rise dramatically in older adulthood for women as well as for men to rates that are much higher than they are here in the United States. In terms of methods used, in general, those tend to be quite situation-specific. People use methods that are available to them, although I believe that suicide behavior in older people, as I said, it tends to be more deliberate, and the methods used tend, in general, to be more immediately lethal. So where there are tall buildings in New York or Hong Kong, those are tend to be by far the most commonly used method of suicide and highly lethal, whereas here in much of the United States, it's firearms. So that's a pattern that's not specific to older adults. That pattern just tends to be followed at any age group looking across cultures.
Great. And the next question is related to your description of variation in terms of method of suicide. That we had a question about whether there are particular things that people working in congregate living situations need to be alert to in terms of the most common means used by those who attempt or a suicide or die by suicide in congregate living situations.
Right. Yeah, that's a great question. We don't know very much about suicide in senior living communities, as I said, and the means used tend to be the means that are available. So one sees very rarely firearm suicides in long-term care, more likely hanging, strangulation, or suffocation, occasionally medication overdose, or jumping. I think the more general principle is that people need to be alert to policies and procedures and prevent, as I said, people getting to that point where they would consider these options. A more complex question in a way in long-term care is what actually constitutes suicidal behavior, because there is so much in some settings, so much need that an older person might have to express control over his or her environment, that doing things like medication noncompliance or withholding food or drink, is that suicidal behavior, or is that some other effort to gain control over one's life in a situation that they might be feeling acute loss of control? I don't know. That's a tough distinction sometimes to make.
Okay, and a question that came up here is the issue of death with dignity, and people who are proponents of being able to I can't quite make out what this question is, but I think you get the typing, I think, got a little messed up here. But I think the idea that the person was trying to express is that there, for older adults in particular, there are issues around determining when a person wants to die in and their decision to end their life, and kind of what your how you distinguish this issue from suicide.
Mm-hmm. That's for me, I take it.
Anyone who wants to take it.
Can you just say a little bit about that, that suicide, is a very value-laden term. It's a hard one. Certainly, providing older people with a dignified circumstance and opportunity for a good death is our obligation as a society and among mine and others who are providers for older people. Now you look at somebody like George Eastman, that suicide note suggested dignity, that was his self-determined wish to die. But again, I stress that one needs to look beyond that to understand what all of that means to the person, and are there ways that we can be helpful to the person maintaining their dignity and autonomy and a quality of life that's acceptable to them by understanding what the source of the pain for that person is. And a commonality, as a guy named Ed Schneidman called it, of suicide, is that every suicidal person is ambivalent. Some portion of them would like to die, the suicidal portion, but some other portion is always there that would prefer to have it some other way. And our job as providers, in my view, is to help identify what that positive ambivalence is, what the source of the pain is that's fueling the negative side of the ambivalence, and try to alter that balance.
Thank you. We're almost out of time, so I guess I'd like to just give the presenters a chance to share any other thoughts that they'd like to share with the listeners, and then we'll wrap up here. We have preserved all of the questions that came in, and we'll do our best to the extent we can after this webinar to reply to you or point you to resources if your question was not heard during this webinar session. But are there any last thoughts or messages that any of the presenters wish to share?
This is Chris. I just wanted to say that the toolkit is very focused on, senior living communities and residents and staff there. But I would encourage folks who work in community settings, or if you're in a state agency or organization that maybe serves community organizations, to also take a look at it, because I think you'll find that there's a lot of information in there. The trainings could be adapted for community settings, and a lot of the tools I think you would find would be useful for a variety of settings.
And this is Roz. I just wanted to encourage people who download the web-based version at this point, if you would please be willing to consider signing on for the customer satisfaction survey, which you do after about 3 months, because it would really be helpful for us to know how useful or effective you found this toolkit so that we can continue to improve our product. Thank you.
Okay.
I have nothing more to add. It's been a privilege. Thank you.
Well, thank you all so much. I really appreciate you joining this session and sharing your presentations. And thanks to all of you who participated in this webinar by phone and by internet connection. Your contributions were appreciated, your comments and questions. And I just want to remind you that we will email you a copy of the slide set, but you can also go to www.sprc.org. At a later time, I think it may take us a few days to get it up there, and we'll have the audio recording as well. So you can listen to this whole webinar again or encourage your colleagues to do so. And SPRC also has a number of other resources that might be of interest to you, so feel free to visit www.sprc.org, particularly the online library, and you can look under the section on populations and older adults to see more downloadable resources related to suicide prevention in older adults that are available free of charge to you. So thank you all very much, and we look forward to having you spend time with us again on future SPRC Research Tool Practice webinars. Take care.